Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Joe Biden's Indo-Pacific strategy. With me to discuss the Biden administration's policy toward the Asia-Pacific, and particularly how those policies are viewed in Southeast Asia, is Lin Kwok. Lin is the Shangri-La Dialogue Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Security at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where she co-edits IISS's Asia-Pacific Regional Security Assessment. Lin is based in Singapore, but is also a visiting professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and has taught at the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service Institute. Lin, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, James. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Lin, I want to talk about the Biden administration's policies, but I think where I'd like to begin is with a little bit of a backdrop in context and get your read of how Joe Biden's election was read in Southeast Asia, at least on average. I know there's differences among countries, but to what extent were people pleased, concerned, not interested at all? How would you assess sort of the view of the Biden ascension from Southeast Asia?
Southeast Asia was generally welcoming of the Biden administration coming to power. But I would say that Southeast Asia didn't think too harshly about the Trump administration. So the contrast between the Trump and the Biden administration, the welcome that Southeast Asia gave to it, wasn't as stark as, say, the distinction in the United States and in much of Europe. So I would say that the Biden administration was welcomed because it brought a degree of stability. The Trump administration was perceived as very, very chaotic, and much of it was quite traumatic for the countries who never knew what the Trump administration would be doing next. However, the Trump administration did implement some good policies that the region welcomed, and that was most stark in the South China Sea. I could go into that a little bit.
Please do. I think that would be helpful for people to get a sense of what it was about Trump's policies, however chaotic or erratic they might have been, that resonated with countries like Singapore, Indonesia, Vietnam, and the rest.
I think the most important thing that the Trump administration did was that after a lapse of about 4 years of the tribunal decision in the South China Sea case that the Philippines brought against China, the Trump administration finally embraced the tribunal decision, the merits of the case, and made it part of U.S. policy as well. So whereas, you know, for the 4 years preceding 2020, when the Trump administration did that, the focus of the United States and its allies was predominantly on freedom of navigation operations, the right of the U.S. and its Navy to traverse the South China Sea. In 2020, the Trump administration, in particular Secretary Pompeo's statement of July 2020, stated that it was endorsing and accepting the tribunal decision, particularly that part of it which stated that China has no rights to a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone from features in the Spratlys.
And that, of course, greatly limited China's claim to the South China Sea, though Beijing has never recognized that ruling, correct, Lin?
Beijing has never recognized that ruling. It rejected the tribunal's jurisdiction. It said that the tribunal had no jurisdiction to hear the case because, in essence, it was a case about sovereignty over land features, and the tribunal had no jurisdiction to hear sovereignty issues. In other words, it had no jurisdiction to determine which country has a better claim to land features, because the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea does not deal with competing claims to land features. But I think what's important to note is that the Philippines actually defined its case as one that sought clarity over the nine-dash line and what China can lawfully claim from the nine-dash line, as well as the status and maritime entitlements of features in the Spratlys, as well as Scarborough Shoal. So I think in that respect, Beijing was completely wrong to say that the tribunal had no jurisdiction to hear the case, because the tribunal clearly had jurisdiction to determine the status and maritime entitlements of features in the Spratlys.
So countries across Southeast Asia actually saw a lot they liked in the Trump administration's policies toward the region, particularly in the question of the South China Sea. Now you have a change in administration. Joe Biden comes in. I think it's pretty clear, at least in Washington, that Joe Biden has set forth China as job number one for U.S. foreign policy. I'm curious, from the region, how is Joe Biden's Indo-Pacific strategy seen? What do you see it as being?
Well, I read a recent paper you wrote, James, about Biden's Indo-Pacific strategy, and I thought that was a very good framing article. And so perhaps, if I may, I'll use your framing of how to assess the Biden administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. So you started off.
Okay, thank you for the plug, and hopefully the South Koreans will publish it soon.
I'm sure they will. So you started off with examining the strategy itself or the content of the Indo-Pacific strategy. And I would say that I completely agree with you that the primary difference between the Biden and the Trump administration lies not in the substance of the policy, but in its implementation, with Biden obviously seeking to work more effectively with allies and partners. And I say seeking to work more effectively with allies and partners, of course, because the recent fallout over Afghanistan, as well as the AUKUS submarine deal, puts that into question, puts the ability of the Biden administration to work effectively with allies and partners in question. I think it's fair to say that both President Trump or the Trump administration, as well as the Biden administration, share the same goals, although Trump had the audacity to put this, you know, forthrightly as America first. I don't think it's surprising that a country puts its national interests first. I'm currently based in Singapore, and I would be very surprised if Singapore said, you know, Malaysia first, or Malaysia said Singapore first. That's just not going to happen. I think the difference really lies in whether a country considers its national interests best served working with allies and partners and through multilateral frameworks, as the Biden administration clearly does, or it considers its national interests best served by forging a more solitary path. So certainly, I think the difference is in means, not in desired ends. I think the second way you assess the Biden administration's Indo-Pacific strategy is through looking at the implementation of the strategy. I think that although it's tried to lead with diplomacy and focus less on military means, at least that's what the Biden interim national security strategic guidance sought to say, it's been quite weak in terms of even this diplomatic prong in its approach to Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia didn't receive its first high-level visitor from the United States till 7 months after President Biden took office. The visit by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin in late July was followed by VP Kamala Harris's visit in mid-August. And both these visits were cheered by the region. It was welcomed by the region, but they were very much regarded as the United States playing catch-up after 7 months of absence.
Lynn, can I ask you about that? Because I found that quite surprising. It would have seemed that in your foreign policy playbook on page one, if your argument is going to be, we're going to rally like-minded countries, our friends, partners, and allies, that you would actually show up pretty early, at least some of these critical countries. So what has the read been in Southeast Asia about the fact that the Biden administration isn't showing up until 7 months in? Is it, we'll give them a pass this time, or are people concerned that the administration is signaling where they rank Southeast Asia, countries like Singapore, Indonesia, in the pecking order?
The United States has always paid lip service to the centrality of ASEAN and the importance of Southeast Asia to its Indo-Pacific strategy. I think there can be no question that Southeast Asia is important or should be important to the Indo-Pacific strategy. It lies at the geographic heart of the Indo-Pacific strategy. And China has been assiduously cultivating ties in the region. So it should be an important area of priority for the Biden administration. But I do think that the lack of a high-level visitor to the region till so late on in the Biden administration hurt the United States. There was meant to be an earlier virtual meeting between Secretary of State Blinken with his counterparts, but this was put off to great consternation in the region because of a technical glitch when Secretary Blinken was actually on his way to the Middle East. So I think his Southeast Asian counterparts were waiting behind a computer monitor for about 45 minutes for that glitch to be resolved.
Ouch.
Yeah, the region took some offense. I think they've since, you know, smoothed over ties by sending both the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, as well as Vice President Harris to the region. So, you know, that's been a very positive sign. But, you know, diplomacy can only go so far. So even if the United States were to get its diplomacy in the region right, it still needs to go beyond that to kind of walk the talk about Southeast Asia being important. And of course, it faces several challenges in that respect.
Okay, well, I want to get to those challenges. I should note that even though we're 8 months into the Biden administration. The Biden administration still does not have ambassadors in any of these countries. That's actually a systemic problem. I think we only have 2 confirmed U.S. ambassadors right now. That reflects partly the slowness of the administration and partly holdups in the United States Senate. So I assume that probably adds to the sense of the United States not paying sufficient attention to things in Southeast Asia. But I'm curious, before we go into the steps the Biden administration might take, Lynn, I was wondering if you could just give me a sense as to whether or not the countries that you follow in Southeast Asia have a similar read or similar concern about China, or to what extent countries in the region, again, I'm sure it may differ as you look around Southeast Asia, have a different read on the challenge that China presents.
On China, I think there's no doubt that many countries in the region are worried about Chinese actions, particularly in the South China Sea, but also beyond that in terms of interference within societies. But in the South China Sea, for instance, China is encroaching upon the exclusive economic zones of Southeast Asian countries. It's sending hundreds of vessels at certain points to features occupied by Southeast Asian countries. And of course, it's sought to object to a certain of maritime rights by the US and other powers in the international waters of the South China Sea. So all these actions on China's part leads to great concern among Southeast Asian countries, especially since encroachments upon their exclusive economic rights hurt their rice bowl because of the fishing resources and oil and gas resources, which these developing countries greatly need. But, you know, they have a very complex relationship with China. So despite these concerns about China, they speak less, for instance, about China's actions and more about not wanting to choose between the United States and China. And so we hear this refrain very, very often. You know, Southeast Asia does not want to choose between the United States and China. But my sense is that this is a way of sidestepping concerns about assertive and at points unlawful Chinese actions in the region as well without necessarily incurring China's wrath. So yeah, China isn't viewed well in the region. That said, I think it would be wrong to conclude from that simply because it isn't viewed well and it's viewed warily, that China has no influence in the region. I think quite the opposite. You know, there's polling to support this negative view of China in the region. So in an Institute of Southeast Asian Studies poll that was published earlier this year, when elites in Southeast Asia were asked who they would align itself with if it had to choose between the US and China, 61.5% chose the United States and only 38.5% chose China. Can we then infer from that the US has an easy ride in Southeast Asia? I think not, because if we look at another important statistic in terms of who is regarded as the most influential economic power in Southeast Asia, China far outstrips the United States. I was actually very surprised by this statistic. It's 76.3% chose China compared to a mere 7.4% the United States. When I mentioned this to just the general populace, they were actually surprised that the gap wasn't even broader. So this was a poll of elites, but the non-elite or the general populace actually thought that China's economic influence was far, far greater than the United States. And of course, this may not have implications right now for countries' security ties with the United States and the United States' influence in the region. But moving forward in terms of the trajectory of relations with China or the United States, I think the United States should be concerned.
I take your point, Lynn, that China is an economic powerhouse and exerts enormous gravitational pull, particularly in its neighborhood. In Southeast Asia is pretty close to China. And I also understand your point that countries in Southeast Asia would prefer not to have to choose. They obviously must worry that if they were to be seen as being too pro-American, that China may retaliate in ways. We've seen the Chinese bring economic pressure over the course of this year against Australia for a variety of reasons. So that leads me to ask, what is it that Southeast Asian countries are hoping the Biden administration will do? They don't want to choose, but they obviously don't want the United States to cede the region to China. So what would be the ideal policy that people in countries like Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam would rally around?
The region hasn't been terribly clear about this, but here's what I think should be their policy and how the United States should approach the question. I think the framing shouldn't be a choice between the United States and China. China, it should be framed as support for a rules-based international order, lest countries lose their sovereign rights or their freedom of choice or their autonomy of action. And this is something that no country wants. And when we start talking about a rules-based order, this is something that China in principle actually also talks about, how it supports the rule of law as well. I think its quarrel has never been about, you know, whether international law should apply. Its quarrel has always been about its interpretation of international law is different from the United States and some others. So, you know, I won't say that there will be no trouble from China if Southeast Asia came out more strongly in favor of the rules-based international order. I think China has shown that it will still punish some of these countries for doing so. But I think it's an easier case to make, and it's also a more justifiable one. So we look even at Europe's role in all of this, and I think Europe has a big part to play in terms of, you know, maintaining the balance of power and defending the rules-based international order. You know, in a sense, that's a softer approach than a hard-on US-China competition, but it can't be so soft that it's all about words and there's no willingness to commit resources to supporting the rules-based international order, because sometimes that takes risk and sometimes that takes resources. And, you know, whether it's Europe or it's Southeast Asia, these two regions absolutely do need to start taking some risk and expending some resources in terms of supporting this rules-based international order, because, you know, you can have no economic security in the long run if that rules-based international order isn't supported. In the short run, perhaps, and I think that's what everyone's focused on, but in the long run, you know, you lose that degree of autonomy to even make economic choices. So if we look at the code of conduct in the South China Sea that's being negotiated, one of the terms that China has sought to include in it, I mean, it's objected to by countries, but one of the terms that China has sought to include in it has been a term that excludes third country companies from cooperating in the maritime economy of Southeast Asian countries. So that's completely exclusionary and it completely confines Southeast Asia's autonomy. So I think that's the sort of situation we're trying to avoid for the future. And we are still able to do that if only countries were a bit more forward-leaning in that respect. And this doesn't have to mean that they come up against China necessarily, but they need to be willing to take some risk to defend the rule of law.
Pursuing this point about support for a rules-based order, taking into account that people can disagree about what the rules are, how to interpret them, or who should get the rules, what is it that countries in Southeast Asia are hoping from the Biden administration in an area like trade?
In an area like trade, I mean, that's such an important question, because trade is a means by which the United States can show that its engagement in the region is broad-based and multifaceted and isn't merely focused on strategic competition with China. And so when the United States under President Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, that was a huge missed opportunity for the United States. Under the Biden administration, I think President Biden has also somewhat tied America's hands behind its back by its foreign policy for the middle class, given that the U.S. Interim National Security Strategic Guidance, which was issued in March this year, makes clear that Washington will only pursue new trade deals after it has made investments in American workers and communities. So I think that's a little bit problematic for the United States, at least in the short to medium term, while it's seeking to make investments in American workers and communities. So it kind of leaves the United States without a very important tool for more deeply engaging with the Indo-Pacific region and for competing with China. I think in his piece for the Foreign Affairs magazine, this was published in August last year, the Prime Minister of Singapore actually highlighted how the importance of trade deals, and in this case, I think he was focused in particular on the CPTPP, goes beyond the mere economic gains that the region and the United States may gain from it. But the importance of such trade deals strategically, you know, it's an opportunity for countries to cooperate with one another, to develop stakes in one another's success, and together shape the regional architecture and the rules that govern it. So, you know, I think especially with China forging ahead with RCEP, with China, you know, submitting recently a request to accede to the CPTPP, and in such a way presenting itself as a protector of the global trading system, the United States does need to think long and hard about whether or not its interests might actually really best served by re-signing on to the CPTPP.
I should note that the CPTPP is the successor agreement to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Deal that the Obama administration negotiated and Donald Trump took the United States out of. I will note, Lynn, that there's a strong argument to be made that not participating in TPP or CPTPP is not only not good for America's strategic interest in Southeast Asia, it's actually not really good for the American middle class. There's a great piece by Adam Posen, the president of the Peterson Institute, in a recent issue of Foreign Affairs, which goes into this in some detail. But moving away from the issue of trade, how are countries in the region reacting to Joe Biden's talk about democracy and human rights? Clearly, at least on a rhetorical level, the Biden administration has elevated those concerns, spending a lot of time talking about issues like the Uyghurs, the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong. Is that part of the Biden Indo-Pacific strategy resonating in Southeast Asia?
I don't think it resonates very well. The talk about democracy and human rights has always been a very sensitive topic in Southeast Asia, which is a region of illiberal democracies, backsliding democracies, and in some cases, authoritarian states. It's not the best foot forward to be taking in its approach to the region. I can understand why the Biden administration and the Trump administration before that in its final year actually chose to frame U.S.-China competition as a competition or a race between authoritarian states versus democracies. It garners huge amount of domestic support in the United States. It might garner some support with its allies in Europe, but in Southeast Asia, this is a framing that works very poorly. I think the region is concerned about it unnecessarily deepening divisions between the United States and China. Such an approach also alienates potential partners in the region. If we think about accusations of authoritarian states or communist states being liars, I mean, this took place under the Trump administration. I think Secretary Pompeo called communist states liars. You know, that sort of language is going to resonate very poorly in countries like Vietnam, for instance. And Vietnam has been identified by the Biden administration as an important partner in the region. So it would best avoid such language. And I think the third reason why this ideological framing is problematic for the region is that it could open up strategic space for China and in the long run be counterproductive insofar as achieving democracy is concerned. So insofar as the U.S. goal is to bolster democracy, we might actually see a greater erosion of democracy if the United States is not careful.
And Lynn, how are countries in the region reacting to the Biden administration's efforts to breathe life into the Quad and this AUKUS submarine deal?
The Quad deal was initially viewed quite warily, and I think to a certain extent that sentiment remains today. It was considered the military arm to the Indo-Pacific strategy, in a sense, the more militarized version. Of course, that notion of it has since dissipated somewhat given the AUKUS deal. But I think it's notable that in the ASEAN Outlook on the Indo-Pacific, which was issued in the summer of 2019, there was no mention of the Quad deal. And instead, ASEAN actually focused more on the importance of economic integration and economic connectivity. So I think they eschewed all mention of the Quad deal. Since then, I think the Quad has evolved somewhat to focus more on other issues that matter more to Southeast Asia. So like their agreement on vaccine distributions, right? How the United States and Japan would pay for vaccines, Australia would help distribute vaccines, and India would help manufacture these vaccines. So this is something that the region welcomed, and this is the sort of thing that the Quad should be focusing on. In terms of AUKUS, the reaction in the region has been somewhat mixed. I think on one end, you have countries like Indonesia and Malaysia expressing grave concerns about the militarization of the region, of the arms race that's occurring in the region. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have the Philippines, where Secretary Loxin, the foreign minister, actually issued a very strong statement saying that this is very good for the region because it helps to maintain the regional balance of power, giving Australia, a near neighbor, greater ability to support the balance of power in the region. And then in between, you have all the rest of the countries. Singapore has been said to welcome the deal, the AUKUS deal. That might be a bit too strong. I think what the prime minister did say was that he hoped that this would contribute to peace and stability and that it would complement the existing regional architecture. So I think to say that he welcomed it would be a little bit too strong. But nonetheless, I think in general, the countries in between do generally see it as positive in terms of supporting the balance of power, provided Australia, the UK, the United States are not confrontational, but, you know, they're not going to come out openly to support the deal. So I think they're quite cautious about angering China in this respect.
Oh, that gets back to your point about the preference not to have to choose, at least not to have to choose publicly. Lynn, I want to go back to a point you made near the beginning of our conversation, which was the consequences of the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan on perceptions of U.S. credibility. Obviously, for the Biden administration, if it's going to have a successful Indo-Pacific strategy, it has to be able to persuade people that it's going to do what it says it is going to do, more or less along the timeline that it has laid out. And, you know, back in August, the airwaves here in the United States were full of people talking about the death of American credibility because of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. A lot of that was, you know, talk that's in the heat of the moment. Now that we're at least 2 months away from the fall of Kabul, I wonder what your sense is, your read is in the region of how the Afghanistan withdrawal is viewed in terms of American reliability. Is it the case that people are worried that America is going to cut and run from Southeast Asia as well? Or is it the sense that Afghanistan's a different place, U.S. had fewer vital interests, and so it doesn't really have any long-term resonance or impact?
Well, I think what's happening in Afghanistan is obviously a great tragedy, but in terms of its impact on the geopolitics of the region, I think that will be less than what the original hue and cry might suggest. The decision to withdraw from Afghanistan and its symbolic execution have obviously been milked by China to suggest, first, that the United States security guarantees are unreliable, and second, that the U.S. execution is poor. So even if it were reliable, it just cannot execute. So it was a bit of an embarrassment for the United States. And of course, these criticisms will no doubt impact U.S. credibility in the short run. And to a certain extent, you know, some in the region do question U.S. credibility. On the other hand, I think the hard truth is that U.S. credibility in the region has for some time now been questioned. But this is not going to stop countries in the region from working with the United States. Even an unreliable partner is better than none in terms of seeking to maintain the region's balance of power. And I think the argument goes is that, and I think I believe this as well, that the withdrawal from Afghanistan could actually allow the United States to focus more on the Indo-Pacific. I say could because, you know, it might not necessarily do so, but I think all signs are that it will. And that, you know, I think in this respect, withdrawal from Afghanistan allows the United States to focus on the main area of competition right now. I think it's also important to remember that many of the things that were said about the U.S. credibility and wherewithal in the aftermath of Afghanistan were also said when the United States withdrew from Vietnam, but that didn't stop the United States from being the region's unchallenged hegemon in the decades to follow. So I think if we are to take any lesson away from Afghanistan, is that it's less about reliability and commitment, but more about shared interests, and that having convergent interests matters. And so what that means in turn is that A, the region will have to ensure that it remains relevant to the United States, and B, that the United States in turn will have to show, if it is to assure the region, that it has enduring interests in the region and it is here to stay because of those enduring interests.
Well said, Lynn. And on that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Lynn Kwok, Shangri-La Dialogue Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Security at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Lynn, it's been a pleasure to chat.
Thank you so much, James. It's been a real privilege to be on your show. Delighted to be here.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The books and speeches mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thanks as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.